Oh, there she is, as soon as you say that. Okay, thank you, Debbie. Good afternoon, welcome everyone. I call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Monday, February 20th, 2017. I'm gonna go ahead and open an informational hearing on Care Works. Let's see here. We're going to invite Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the Care Economy for University of Wisconsin, to come up and speak. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank
so
you.
I'm going off of what I have in front of me, and so maybe you can clarify who you're with and the connection to University of Wisconsin. In the interest of full disclosure, I am a Badger.
Well, go Badgers!
Wow. Let's see, let me get my stuff here. Chair Taylor and members of the committee, I'm Laura Dresser from a place called the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, COWS, at UW-Madison. It's a research center on the university campus in the Social Science Building, with a focus on policy and research to help build the high road, we call it, of stronger economies and stronger outcomes for working people. So just a little bit on my background so that you will know why you should listen to me a little bit. I have a PhD. I'm a labor economist. My PhD is from the University of Michigan. And I've done a lot of research over the years on different sorts of service sector jobs, mostly, although also manufacturing as well. A lot of time thinking about child care work and home care work, the front line of healthcare work, hands-on healthcare work. And I, over time, began to see the similarities, the kind of consistencies about the way the U.S. approaches those sectors of care work, and have thought a lot about what some of the limitations of the national approaches to care work are and how to do something different. So that's kind of my background and why actually I wrote a paper that I think some folks in Oregon saw and invited me to think a little bit more specifically about the Oregon care economy. I was happy to do that and honored to do so because I grew up in Pullman, Washington, but my whole family, or much of my family, lives in Oregon now. So it's...
So, Ms. Dresser, I'm going to interrupt for one moment. So, Ms. Dresser's only here today from out of town, so we're hearing her a little bit out of sequence than we maybe would have heard from her otherwise. But she's an expert in this area, and it's an important issue for us to look at here in the Senate Workforce Committee. I just want to put a little context for the committee members.
All right.
Why? Because we've been talking about our employment retirement and public employee retirement system up until now, and so now we're changing gears. I just wanted to put in context for folks
excellent.
What we're talking about here.
Well,
today.
Hopefully,
so thank
I'm
you.
A,
go ahead and proceed.
Hopefully, I'm a welcome break for
yes,
the
of
committee
course.
On care work. So, I guess the bottom line that I would like to. The report is called Oregon's Care Economy. You all should have had copies delivered to your offices, and let the folks at CareWorks, Oregon CareWorks, know if you need them. I think the bottom line in many ways, though, is that the care economy is something that connects directly and intimately and constantly with the Oregon economy. It is underinvested and often invisible. And that lack of attention and investment consistently means that economic growth, children's outcomes, quality of care, all are short of what they could be with a more systematic and substantial approach to the care economy. So that's kind of the bottom line background about this report, and what we're thinking about is that this is a public good. Care is a public good that we have privatized or not seen, and deserves the kind of investment that so much of our other infrastructure, physical infrastructure, we often see, the infrastructure of actually taking care of people we often don't invest in. And I think to the limitation of our economy and to the detriment of especially women and people in need of care, so the very young and the very old. So I am putting together in this report something we call the care economy, which includes from the very first days of life to the very last days of life. It includes paid and unpaid care. It includes work that helps people keep independent for disabled individuals, and work for those who can make no decisions for themselves. So that's, you know, the intimate keeping alive care. That's the kind of care we're talking about. We all provide it. We all have experienced it. Some of us have done it for pay, but all of us will do it at some point in our lives. It defines, in many ways, our economy. It also, you know, is worth remembering, it is not something that's very easily replaced by a robot. In fact, technology doesn't substitute for care. It is not the same. You can't hand a baby over to a computer screen and expect the same outcomes. Care is personal and physical, and it is about a connection. And so it is about the future of this economy as well. The argument of the paper is basically that this is a large, often invisible workforce and field, and it is underinvested. We divide the work into two groups. The people who are paid, there are about 70,000 paid care workers in the state of Oregon. 56,000 of them are in home care or institutional care for the elderly, or in working with people with disabilities on the healthcare side, hands-on healthcare. Another 14,000 are in child care, both providing as home care providers in their own homes, as well as people who work at child care centers. Ooh, I flipped one, didn't I? Look at that. So there's 70,000 workers, and you could see this in the report. I know this is awfully small for you to see. The bottom line on what you're seeing there is that basically the wages for care workers are roughly $10 an hour. That's both on the home care side and on the child care side. That's inside child care centers and inside nursing homes, a little bit higher. I think it's also worth emphasizing that the jobs are not only very low wage jobs, fast growing jobs, but also very weak benefits jobs. The workers in child care and healthcare, these frontline hands-on caregivers, generally do not get health insurance through their employment. They generally have weak or non-existent retirement benefits. And especially on the home health side, the hours of work are very hard to secure or stabilize. And so you're looking at a low wage, but also a very difficult time turning it into a strong, steady income, because every time your client is sick or on vacation, sick in the hospital or on vacation, you lose your shift. All of the volatility of demand is borne by the workers in home health. The one other sector I'd point out to you here is the family child care providers. Wages in family providing situations are consistently lower, and it's worth remembering that minimum wage increases do not impact them. They are proprietors of their own establishments, generally earning six, seven. This is consistent with national data on how low wages are for family providers. I have a quote up there, a story from Lindsay, who was a child care worker who could not find a way to stay in the industry because the wages were so low. I want to just have that. You can look at that and other stories in the report. But I want to turn a little bit to thinking about the amount of unpaid care. Unpaid care is very hard to measure, as you can imagine. Does it count, for example, as care when you take your child to the grocery store? The best way to kind of come up with the hours of care time is to do very detailed diaries of time expenditure. Very difficult. Anyway, the bottom line on it is that even very conservatively measured, so people report they are doing care, not that care is mixing in with other things, but they are doing care. One in four of all women in the state of Oregon are doing care. Generally, the average of those caregivers, 2 hours a day. the unpaid caregivers, 1/7 of all men, about 1.5 hours a day. Just putting that conservatively measured work with children and then work with adults all together, you get 500 million hours of work in Oregon, or a workforce of 167,000 full-time workers. The equivalent is an army of 167,000 full-time care workers in the state. That's what all that 1 in 4 women doing 2 hours a day, like a quarter-time job, adds up to in the state. Those workers are stressed both by the difficulty of balancing work and family and the difficulty of paying for the care that they buy in the market. So I want to kind of flag that one, there are sort of three problems, and it depends on whose eyes you're looking at through in the care economy, but there are three problems at least. If you are looking through the eyes of the person who is trying to purchase care, you see two problems right away. The first is the affordability is a very serious issue. Infant care in the state of Oregon, $14,000 a year. That's $7 an hour. So that's $7 of anybody's wage going straight to childcare. So affordability is a serious issue, and quality from the consumer side is a serious issue. Why is quality a serious issue? Because on the wage side, $10 an hour generates a lot of turnover. So $10 an hour is a pretty close to the bottom of the labor market job. It's very hard to be unstressed and stably connecting to the clients, consumers, children, whoever you're working with at $10 an hour. So the chances of turnover are very high. That's a big stress maker on the consumer side. If you go to the worker side, the wage is so low that it is hard to stay in the job. We see increasing demands for skill and education in the jobs, which is good, but we nationally have not seen very commensurate rewards in wages to that increasing education demand. So driving up quality is good, but it is very hard to drive quality very far at $10 an hour. And that's what that quote from the childcare provider proved. And that leaves unmet needs. I would say there's a lot of evidence, and this is in the paper as well, that a different approach, a substantial systemic investment in infrastructure for childcare and home health care systematically can change the way your economy works. And it changes the way the economy works. It improves the way it works for women specifically, because women so often carry the burden of the care on the family side. And that takes them away either physically from work, or they stop paying as much attention to work. It could systematically help low-income families, especially who face the cost of cares that is so brutal. And it can also generate economic growth where you both are investing in higher quality care so that children do better later in their lives. So we know that investments in kids pay off in the long run, not only for their kids and their families, but also for the economy in general, and the same for women and having that support on care. So what does a systemic infrastructure for care include? We just identify three key elements. Supporting families when their care needs are most intense, so that's paid family leave, when children are born, children come into families, time of sickness and death, that's make really strong attention to the questions of affordability and accessibility of senior care and child care, and then really systemic and consistent attention to wages in that, so that you are not going to, you don't get to solve these problems simply by always paying attention to accessible and affordability and letting people stay home. The wages have to move, or the industry will not change and these problems will still exist. And so that is my introduction to this report. And now it's like you've read it.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. It is such an important issue. We want to make certain that care providers are being paid for, being paid an adequate wage. Do you have any sense of the shortfall that we have in the state? Is there any information on that? Probably other folks know that, but
If you kind of back of the envelope, that 70,000 workers are earning about 10,000 per year, and probably need to be earning more like 15. Mm-hmm. The math comes out of that. We did not do that math specifically in here, although I've done that on a national paper. It would be a serious investment.
Yeah. And then do you want us to do, I noticed in here this about the gender divide, is there,
So it's worth remembering, and you probably knew, of those 70,000 workers, more than 90% are women. So women are the paid caregiving labor force, childcare usually 95% and above, mm-hmm. I don't have this, and home care 90 and above. So it is mostly a workforce of women, but and I think importantly on the other side, the stress generated disproportionately falls on women. The daughters who take care of the parents, the new mothers who take care of the children, in general, women are spending, as you can see, more than twice as much time as men on caregiving in the unpaid side of things. And so relieving the burden, either by stabilizing care, making it more affordable, or making it more possible to stay home, all of that generally is a support to gender equity as well, to helping support women in that dual role and helping it make more sense for anyone to be in that, to support people who choose that role, men and women both. But given the way we divide that household division of labor, currently, it's disproportionately women who would gain from that.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Senator Hensel.
Just one quick question. And you said 1 in 4 women, Oregon women, do 2 hours a week in volunteer care work. Did I hear you say that?
Not exactly. 1 in 4 women. This is a national. I took national data because there is not time diary data from the state of Oregon. 1 in 4 women nationally, and so I assume the same for Oregon, it's 2 hours per day, are providing 2 hours and 15 minutes per day of care work.
Okay.
And so multiplying that out is how you get to the $500 billion.
Follow up?
Senator Hansen.
I mean, like with family, 2 hours a day, I would assume that was mostly within family arrangements.
Yes, that's an answer only about in family provision. So that's unpaid care. And it's a hard thing to measure because many women are spending an entire day, right, doing care when their children are very little, but it averages out as children age, and many women don't have any kids in the house at all. So over that, you get the 1 in 4 with an average of 2 hours. Does that make sense?
Well, I guess. Always thought that mothers cared for their families. And we're saying that they should be paid to care for their families? Or dads care for their families? Is that what we're saying here?
No. Well, that's a interesting question. This report is not saying that. What this is saying is that, yes, families is a site of where care happens, right? And care, defining exactly what we mean by care is very hard. Is helping your 13-year-old son with his math care work not in this definition? Is it what we want to see happen in families? Yes. So I'm just using, when people report on a form that they spent time taking care of someone, that's what gets listed in this. And I think the important point is to acknowledge that there is a lot of care work that goes in homes and a lot of care work that goes on for pay, and that both of those come with a lot of stress for the people who provide the care, especially the ones who are trying to balance, the stress of a high cost of care with demands of work, with the demands of family, and come up with a balance on that. And so that's what those hours are supposed to have a help shine a spotlight on.
Well, I don't want to.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I'm really having a hard time why that's even relevant. If I, as a parent, are if I'm coaching my children in an athletic event, or how to show a 4-H pig, or how to do homework, I mean, that's being a dad. I don't view that as caregiving. That's what I'm supposed to do. And but you say you can't function out, or you can't separate out any of that normal parental responsibilities or desires to do. And somehow we've got this big unfunded, underfunded, whatever. I mean, I'm not getting paid anything for it when I was raising my kids.
Right. And I think, so one thing is those are separated out.
They are.
The homework doesn't count. This is 2 hours when the person filling out the form says, I am providing care, and that generally means infant. You know,
what is the definition of care then?
Yeah, then that's what I need. Yeah.
What is the definition of care?
It's on a survey. They're asked to fill out by hour what they're doing, and you pick, you know, on the basis of a set of definitions from this diary that comes up that you're interacting with.
For example.
And so they would. So you, I think you would. You would say care is, you know, like when I'm providing, I'm changing diapers, I'm putting an infant to sleep, I'm, you know, carrying an infant. That's when people check the care box. It's a more narrow definition of care.
Well, that's my point. I mean, they're being moms. I mean, you change a diaper, you've warmed the bottle, dress the child. I mean, I don't understand why that now is underpaid.
Okay. So I think we try and say, I think what I was trying to do with this is not to say what we need to do is pay all care work. And I think what the charge was, though, is let's see how paid and unpaid care interact in this economy, and how that is stressing families and limiting economic growth by having women who are trying to balance family and work, and trying to figure out how on a $10 an hour job they can afford care, and how making $10 an hour they can make ends meet. And so it's paying attention to the interaction of these things, not that care should be paid, but that at certain points in time, in intense need, that would be a moment where maybe the person would like to have the opportunity to take care of a kid, a brand new infant. That intense time of care, that's when a paid family leave program, for example, can help a mom or a dad stay home with someone who's brand new and needs care. In that, that's an answer to that unpaid care need. Not all unpaid care, but the specific intense need of an addition or a sickness, death in a family, giving people time to pay attention to that care, because that's part of the care that's happening in people's lives. But then also looking at this workforce of the 70,000 workers that are part of the infrastructure that everyone's relying on as well.
Okay, Senator Gossett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think about it in a different way, and I hear what you're saying. But if I understand the point of the report where you talk about the interaction, any 15-minute increment or hour increment that I spend doing one thing is time that I can't spend doing another. So if I'm a single mother and I'm caring for my children, the work has to happen. If the baby is sick, someone needs to care for the baby. If the baby needs a diaper change, the diaper needs to be changed. But the food still needs to be bought, the milk still needs to be bought, the rent still needs to be paid. So there's that trade-off between how do I do this work, and what's my economic value of doing this work when I'm at home doing that work, which doesn't mean to be paid, but there is a value, because if I were to leave that place and go to work, I would have to pay, my family would have to find a way to pay for that work to be done. I think two examples that I can think of that aren't kids. I know my in-laws live in Massachusetts. My father-in-law isn't doing particularly well right now. My sister-in-law lives there. She's the only sibling that lives there. She has three small boys under the age of six, and several times a day has to stop everything that she's doing to pick up the kids and go to respond to whatever it is that her dad needs. If something, and she loves to do it. She would not ask to be paid to do it. She has not complained about doing it. But she's also been very generous with her time in doing that. And that's time she can't spend with her children. And it's not time. It's not a task that's easily purchased because it's expensive and difficult to structure. Or alternately, I could, in my own family, we've got an adult disabled child, and we had a little bit of a hubbub at our house this morning because we realized it was President's Day. We're not sure if his program was open this morning. Neither of us thought of that until about 7 o'clock. And the question was, okay, who doesn't go to work today? In order to provide that care that needs to be done. So I don't think either of us would want to be paid for that, but there's an economic trade-off cost of how do you put all of these things together. Some of us have more options than others, and being able to bring that care and help in to get it done. And for everybody got to go to work. Yeah. The program wasn't closed.
And I appreciate that point from Senator Gelzer and your question, Senator Hansel. I think that is right to draw attention to this question of how does care happen. Your sister can afford to do that, but for so many people, it is financially impossible to figure out a way to take care of the father while maintaining the job. And to help see that care as producing real value and think about ways to help support people in that as part of what this report is due. So I appreciate both of the questions.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Yes, I hope everything is going well in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
We have to go to the Rathskeller for me.
Yeah, and, okay.
Appreciate that.
Done.
All right.
Thank you.
And so we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing, and we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 92. And I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize the bill.
Please. Okay. This bill comes to you at the request of Governor Kate Brown from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is the first time this committee is hearing this bill. SB 92 restricts the amount of civil penalties that the Department of Consumer and Business Services can assess for violations of state occupational safety or health statute, lawful rules, standards, or other in conformity with minimum and maximum penalties under the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970.
Okay, I'm going to call Michael Wood from the Oregon OSHA Department, please.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knope, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we generally refer to simply as Oregon OSHA. We have brought this bill forward because Congress in November of 2015 made a change that resulted in an increase in federal OSHA's maximum penalties as well as certain minimum penalties. And they did that as part of the overall Budget Reconciliation Act at that point. They passed a change which made the OSHA Act subject to an Inflation Adjustment Act that had actually been passed a number of years previously that the Federal OSHA Act had previously been exempt from. As a result of that change, there was a catch-up provision that resulted in a not quite 80% increase in the maximum penalties under OSHA, as well as an ongoing provision that the penalties would be adjusted in line with the Federal Consumer Price Index on an annual basis. We're not required to have penalties that are identical to federal OSHA in practice. We are required, as part of our state plan agreement that allows us to operate our own state program for occupational safety and health here in Oregon, we are required to have penalty authority that is in line with the penalty authority that is spelled out in the federal act, as well as in this case, in the budget provisions. And so we've been told by federal OSHA, as have all the other states, that we need to take steps to change the penalty authority, or to ask that you change our penalty authority, so that we are able to comply with that expectation. And SB 92 is the bill that would enable us to do that, not only with regard to that catch-up provision, but also with regard to the annual adjustment. And just to give you a context to that annual adjustment, federal OSHA made the annual adjustment in January of this year. It resulted in a change of about $200 in the maximum penalty. So the maximum after the larger catch-up change for a serious penalty had become $12,471. Previously, it had been $7,000 under the Act. As of January, it became $12,675. Now, I do want to emphasize that that doesn't mean those are the penalties we'd be assessing. Those would be the maximum penalties issued under the Act. We've had the same maximum as federal OSHA for a quarter of a century. Our penalties have not been issued at the same level as federal OSHA. We've relied on a regimen of more modest penalties and somewhat more frequent inspections than they'd rely on, and that has been the enforcement model that has resulted in the success that we've been able to have here in Oregon. We expect that to continue in the future. Our exact use of those penalties has been and would continue to be spelled out in rule. What SB 92 would allow us to do is to also bring the maximums and the minimum for a willful violation, which is also spelled out in the federal law, would be able to bring those into line with the federal law and adjust them over time as the federal law results in further changes, so that we don't have to come back and ask for a $200 change on an annual basis from the Legislative Assembly. So that's essentially what the bill would do. It's part of our requirement that we maintain our at least as effective as status with federal OSHA. That not only results in them providing a certain amount of support for the program through the federal grant, but as you may be aware, we're actually required to have an approved program in order to be able to control our own occupational safety and health destiny at all in the state. The Occupational Safety and Health Act basically supersedes all state and local regulation and then gives it back to states that are able to operate an approved program as Oregon does. We operate such a program. We operate it very successfully. That's the verdict both on a state level, and frankly, it's the verdict from federal OSHA as well. We want to continue to be able to do that, and so we're asking that you make this adjustment in the penalty authority and allow us to make it as we move forward. I would welcome any questions.
Senator?
Should the federal government reduce the maximum penalties, does this bill allow us to do the same?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hensel, that's a very good question. If the federal government were to reduce the maximum penalty, the bill not only allows us to do the same, the bill actually would require us to do the same, because it expressly says that our authority to set the penalties must be guided by the federal penalty levels.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Monson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So right now, if you want to determine a certain penalty or a fee, you have to come to the legislature each biennium to ask for that? I mean, how is it set now?
Chair Taylor, Senator Monson-Anderson, that's also a good question. The penalty authority that exists in the statute now is very broad. It essentially sets the maximum penalty for a serious violation and the maximum penalty for a willful or a repeat violation. When it comes to our practice of how we set the penalties, how we calculate probability, severity, how we take into account the size of employers, how we take into account the specifics of repeat violations, how we factor in the nature of good faith, all of that information we already spell out in rule. So most of the details of how we set penalties, we actually spell out in rule now. It's simply the broad parameters, the minimum and the maximum, that are laid out in statute, and that we'd be asking for a little bit more flexibility so that we can respond to the federal guidance.
Great. You answered my question. Thank you. So you, this bill doesn't take any authority away from the legislature. It's clarifying in setting those maximum penalties. Am I making sense?
Chair Taylor, Senator Monis Anderson, I would not describe the bill as taking authority away from the legislature. It does mean that for future adjustments to the maximum penalty, which of course would have to happen on an ongoing basis under the federal guidance, we would not have to come back to the legislature each time and have that revised on an ongoing basis. Of course, at any time that the legislature chose to take that flexibility away from us, you could certainly do that.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on Senate Bill 92. And you might as well just stay right there because we're going to move right on to Senate Bill 93. So we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 93. And I'm going to ask Deborah again to summarize the bill first, please.
Thank you, Chair Taylor. SB 93 also comes to you at the request of Governor Kate Brown for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is the first time the committee is hearing this bill. SB 93 increases the maximum amount of civil penalties recovered for violations of occupational health and safety standards that may be credited to the Workers' Memorial Scholarship account from $250,000 to $1 million.
Okay, so Mr. Wood, you want to go ahead and give us your thoughts?
Thank you, Chair Taylor. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA. When we sat down to do the analysis related to SB 92, which you just heard, we realized that there were other dollar figures that were spelled out in our statute that also hadn't been updated for some time. And one of those actually resulted in the introduction of SB 94, which was heard in Business and Transportation last week, and which also was the subject of a bill sponsored by Senator Canope addressing the same issue in terms of the outdated penalty provision in the in a toilet provision. So we identified that and brought that bill forward. We also identified the issue that the Worker Memorial Scholarship Fund, that it had been some time since the principal in that fund had been addressed. And the way the Worker Memorial Scholarship Fund works is the scholarships that are paid to survivors of individuals who are killed on the job in Oregon workplaces or individuals who suffer permanent total disability. Those scholarships are paid from earnings from a portion of the premium assessment operating account that is set aside, and it's set aside actually from penalties that are brought in through Oregon OSHA assessments. And that amount was set a number of years ago at $250,000, and we pay scholarships now on those earnings. Those scholarships that we're able to pay at this point, typically for the number of recipients we have, we're able to pay scholarships of $1,000 or maybe $1,250. Obviously, those are meaningful scholarships, but for anybody who's priced out what a college education costs now, they aren't going to make the difference in whether or not a student goes or does not go to college. And if you look at some of the original intention behind the bill, I think it's clear that they were intended to not just be useful and beneficial, but part of the notion was when the Worker Memorial Scholarship was set up was that they'd really offer a material opportunity that would provide an opportunity to, in a sense, change a person's circumstances by making up to some very little way for the loss of frequently the primary breadwinner. And so what this bill would do is simply allow us to set aside an additional $750,000 so that the total in the fund that the earnings would be paid from would be set at $1 million. This actually was the subject of House Bill 2660, which saw some movement in 2009 and didn't end up getting final action by the legislature. It wasn't that at that time wasn't our request bill. It was a bill that came from within the legislature, but it would have done the same thing. And we think that it's appropriate and certainly timely to take this action now.
Okay, any questions? Okay, well, thank you so much. And I'm gonna call up Betsy Earls from AOI, please.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Ms. Earls.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Business Association, or as we sometimes call ourselves, NUCO, because we don't have a name yet.
NUCO?
NUCO.
Co.
You know, new company, NUCO. That aside, AOI and OBA do support Senate Bill 93, which would increase the balance of the scholarship fund that comes from Oregon OSHA penalty fine money. AOI has sat, I have personally sat on the scholarship committee that awards the scholarships for Oregon OSHA for those penalty monies for several years. And, you know, it has become increasingly apparent as we have gone along how diminished the purchasing power of those scholarships has become vis-a-vis the amount of college tuition that students are facing. And as those go, as tuition increases and the balance of that account does not increase, it's just gotten to be more and more of a discrepancy between what students are able to afford and the actual difference we can make. And I think part of the point of the OSHA fund, the scholarship fund, is to make a meaningful difference, not just to help with people whose family members have been fatally injured or, you know, have a permanent total disability. And the way the account is funded at this point in time, I don't think that we're able to accomplish that goal. It's an important goal to AOI and OBA, and we would support your moving Senate Bill 93 forward to help us accomplish that.
Great. Any questions?
Question. I want to ask the question, just mostly get it on the record. Is there any concern amongst the business community that that we might in fact be incentivizing an aggressive, higher fine type behavior on behalf of OSHA in order to beef up this account in their fines, et cetera?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Hansel. AOI has worked closely, well, when they've needed it or when we've needed it, with OSHA for a very long time. We have a long and I think pretty good working relationship with Oregon OSHA in this state, not only with their consultants but with the staff and administration of the department, and that has not been our experience. We've always felt very comfortable with the level of consultation that OSHA provides as a ratio to the level of enforcement officers they provide, and that's something that's very important to us. But as long as we don't see that ratio change, we don't feel that this is going to, you know, if you will, encourage bounty hunting or something like that.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. We're going to go ahead and, well, thank you so much for coming up.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 93, and then we just have one more bill for the day, and Senate Bill 298. We'll open up a public hearing on that. And Deborah, can you summarize that for us, please?
Thank you, Chair Taylor. This bill comes to you from the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation, also the first time this committee is hearing this bill. SB 298 grants the Labor Commissioner discretion in housing discrimination matters over the preparation and pursuit of formal charges in certain situations. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay, I call up Ms. Paloma Sparks from Boley, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 298. The Bureau enforces civil rights protections in housing, public accommodation, and workplaces. This bill relates to our authority when enforcing housing discrimination complaints. In 2015, we pursued legislation to give the agencies a little more discretion. The law prior to 2015, unlike a complaint filed with workplaces, required that if we received a housing complaint and after an investigation, we made a determination that there was substantial evidence, if a complainant or a respondent elected to file the case in civil court, we were required to continue representing the complainant, even if the complainant also had counsel. That was proving quite costly in terms of every time we have to go to civil court, we pay DOJ to represent us. sorry, getting a cold. So the costs were getting out of control. We were having to look at maybe eliminating positions. So in 2015, we pursued legislation to give us some discretion, to make some decisions about whether or not, you know, if a case warranted us continuing to pursue it in civil court, or if we would allow the parties to continue on their own in civil court. If somebody files an employment discrimination complaint with us, we are under no obligation under state law to continue to pursue that case. Part of the reason why the statute was written such a way is that that was a requirement for the U.S. Housing and Urban Development requirement to be considered substantially equivalent with federal laws, which was a requirement of us having a contract with HUD. HUD didn't pay us for our actual costs. They just paid a flat amount for each case. As a result of the discretion we got, we did lose the contract. We continue to aggressively and fairly enforce housing discrimination complaints and make sure that tenants, future home purchasers are all being treated fairly by under the law. But we think that discretion has been valuable. It has allowed us to have a little bit more leverage in terms of negotiating settlements, because we can make a decision about which cases are going to be worth it for us to pursue in civil court. So the Bureau works hard to obtain settlements or pursue cases when appropriate through the contested case hearing process in order to remedy the harm experienced by individuals. Without the passage of Senate Bill 380, the Bureau had no discretion in determining which cases to go forward with, which cases to take to court. There is one case that we continue to argue up to the Ninth Circuit that is not, the value of which we can get for the complainant will never reach the amount of money that we will have spent paying DOJ to represent us. So the Bureau has brought forward this bill because there are instances when it is not appropriate for the agency to move forward with an administrative action or for DOJ to continue to represent individuals who have elected to go to court. The agency should have flexibility in negotiating these cases. We are committed to preventing and prosecuting discrimination in housing while using scarce taxpayer dollars wisely. This new tool has helped us to better allocate bully resources while maintaining effective enforcement. Now I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Does anyone have any? Yes.
So you're saying that there's a complaint that comes to you, and you will then and right now you have to go to court.
Chair Taylor, Senator Monis Anderson. So after we've done a thorough investigation and we've determined that there is substantial evidence that a violation may have occurred, prior to the change that we got in 2015, which will sunset this year if we don't pass Senate Bill 298, we didn't have any discretion whether or not we would go to court if somebody elected to file in court. If they elected to stay in our venue, then we would just continue our process on.
But if they file in court and then you don't want to show up, then what happens to the person that filed in court? There's just no case?
No. Chair Taylor, Senator Monis Anderson. So if they filed a complaint with the Bureau and we've done an investigation and then they elect to file in court, generally, they are represented, and they themselves are filing a lawsuit against the landlord or the homeowner.
Okay.
Or
now I get it.
Okay.
All right, thank
Sorry.
You.
Sorry.
Well, I thought I got it till you had your explanation. Are you required to defend them in court currently? I understood that what you're asking for in this bill is that you can decide whether or not you want to go with them to court. And if you don't feel it's a case or it's worth the expense, then you can decline to do that but with this bill. But currently you can't do that. Is that correct?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, Senate Bill 380, which gave us discretion passed in 2015, that discretion will sunset at this year if we don't pass Senate Bill 298.
Will you please clarify the discretion that was given in the bill from 2015?
Sure. So the discretion given to us in Senate Bill 298 was the ability to make a decision whether or not we would continue representing a case in court. So it's temporary. Prior to 2015, we didn't have any choice about whether or not we would continue to represent parties. And if Senate Bill 298 isn't passed, we will cease to have any discretion in determining whether or not we will continue to represent somebody if they file in civil court.
So 298 is 280, previous 280, without the sunset.
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, correct.
And what discretion, what is the criteria you're using to decide whether or not to carry the case?
Chair Taylor, it varies. So the discretion could be sometimes in consultation with the Department of Justice. They don't think that the case is a good case. It doesn't have a good set of facts for us. Sometimes it is the dollar value isn't worth it. Sometimes we know that they're already represented by adequate counsel. So there could be a whole variety of reasons, but generally speaking, we use this authority very sparingly. It's not something that we automatically would do. We do a whole fact analysis before we determine whether or not we would use our discretion.
I just wanted to clarify because obviously not everyone would be able to afford private counsel. The idea is to protect people who don't have that ability to hire private counsel. So I just wanted to understand when you said it's rarely used, but then there's a whole fact-finding criteria that's used. Is that what is that? What is it you understand about the value, of the dollar value of whether or not it's worth it to go forward? You mentioned DOJ. Are there other criteria that you could share with us? Or we can talk about it more later. We're not having a work session.
It's just Chair Taylor, it's generally whether or not we think it's a good case. A lot of these cases are about sort of a fight over an accommodation that is a relatively low dollar value accommodation that we should be able to negotiate with the landlord to provide. There are sometimes when complainants want to file in court, it's they think that their case is worth more than our investigators or Department of Justice thinks that they'll be able to get.
Well, maybe how many cases are we talking about here that fall that this happens with, just in the most general?
That we've used the discretion?
Yeah.
Two.
You said two.
Okay, what about that? Two cases.
All right, yeah. Senator Montesano.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that sort of following up with what the chair said, is this going to hurt the consumer that makes the complaint?
Chair Taylor, Senator Montesano, we will aggressively and fairly and effectively continue to enforce anti-discrimination laws.
Yeah.
They have the full weight of the Oregon laws under them. Oregon law is actually more protections than federal law. And if there's no reason for somebody to want to leave our venue. But again, we're not going to be using this in our discretion in every case. It depends on the case.
I think you may have already answered my question, but it was kind of like what the chair is. What percentage of the total cases did you choose not to go forward on? You said two out of how many then?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, of cases that elected, I believe there were five. We used it for two of those cases. I'm not sure about those numbers. I'd have to check those.
There were five cases altogether, and of those, you chose not to go to court on two of them, or at least support the person on two of them. Is that correct? Is that what I hear?
After Senate Bill 380 passed and we got some discretion in terms, yes, we've used our discretion twice.
Out of how many total cases?
Total cases, 222 total cases.
You went to court for on 220 of those cases?
No, those were 222 cases that were filed with us.
Okay.
Of those, 5 elected to go to court.
Okay, and of those 5, you chose 2 not to go. Okay,
correct.
And why do so few choose to go to court?
Senator Chair Taylor, we believe that some of the heavy backlog that we were experiencing in the time that we were spent in court has been alleviated because with our new discretion, the parties are more willing to work towards a settlement rather than move to court.
Mm. Okay.
I hate to bring this one up, but I'm thinking of the anti-discrimination against a business in Gresham, was that one of the cases that you took to court then?
Chair Taylor, Senator Monner-Sanderson, I'm not sure which
it's
case.
It's the cupcake business.
Okay. That's a case. That was a public accommodation case. That hasn't gone to court yet. It's on appeal at the Court of Appeals right now.
Right. I'm just trying to.
That was a case that was decided within the hearings unit. Went to a contested case hearing. There was a judgment determination of damages, and that is now under appeal in front of the Court of Appeals.
Senator Knope.
Thank you, Chair Taylor. Paloma, we were talking about this before the hearing, and it seemed like a fair amount of these cases were involving maybe service animals, perhaps. And so can you maybe describe what's taking place? In other words, my take from the conversation is that a landlord wants to charge a fee for the pet, but the pet is really a service animal. And so the remedy is to negotiate with the landlord and say, you're breaking the law, you need to waive the fee, as opposed to let's go to court and try to get this person, you know, $20,000 because they've been aggrieved. Is that kind of the way this is headed and what you're trying to achieve?
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knope, that is correct. Of the complaints that we received, 124 were disability-related. A number of them were assistance animal-related. Sometimes it's about an accommodation related to an assistance animal, but a lot of these cases are related to fees. So
you're negotiating with them to have something waived or whatever. I just want to make certain that people aren't being talked out of filing a case.
No, Chair Taylor.
If they're actually being discriminated against, then we want to make certain that no one, this is where there's perhaps some miscommunication going on between the committee and what's being said here. So I'm trying to understand that.
Chair Taylor, once we've made a determination that the landlord or the homeowner has violated, they've violated our anti-discrimination laws, we then try and move towards a conciliation or a negotiated settlement with both parties. So the goal is to make sure that the landlord is remedying the violation that has occurred. The goal is not to sort of just wipe the slate clean, but to make sure that the tenant has had a remedy, has had an effective remedy. And when we pursue a settlement or a mediation, the goal is not necessarily to punitive, but to just find a remedy.
Okay. Are we all set? Okay, so we are obviously not having a work session. So these three bills, I'm not sure what the date that we'll have. We'll talk about them more. Folks can think about these. see if they have any questions. And, of course, Paloma, I'm sure, will be available for those. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 298. Thank you very much. And our next meeting will be on Wednesday, February 22nd. We'll have a public hearing on Senate Bill 752 regarding pay equity. So do your homework. Come prepared. Should be a lively day. We'll have a lot of people here testifying, talking about a very important issue. And we're going to go ahead and adjourn the Senate Committee on Workforce. Thank you, everyone.